Hello, you're listening to Late Edition Crime Beat Chronicles, a product of Lee Enterprises. My name is Chris Lay, and I'm the podcast operations manager here at Lee. With Late Edition Crime Beat Chronicles, we're presenting notable true crime stories as reported by journalists for the dozens of various Lee Enterprises-owned publications from around America. For this collection of episodes, we are focusing on Omaha, Nebraska, where journalists from the Omaha World Herald newspaper will tell the tale of two sets of brutal double murders that took place 5 years apart and shocked the otherwise quiet neighborhoods where they occurred. Initially, police were confounded by the crimes, but eventually investigators found themselves on the trail of an unlikely suspect whose arrest was followed by a bizarre and high-profile trial. Episode 3, which you're about to hear, was written by Omaha World Herald staff writer Henry Cordes, based on his reporting alongside fellow World Herald journalist Todd Cooper, and it was read for us by the World Herald's digital director, Z. Long. Now, it might go without saying, but given the subject matter here, and every story that we're going to document going forward, there are some obvious content warnings to impart. There are a couple of curse words that are bleeped out, but otherwise everything you hear would be fit to print in a newspaper. That said, parents are still cautioned to give the episode a listen before sharing this with any youngsters. And now, here's Z. Long reading episode 3, The Task Force.
The dozens of reporters and photographers chattering in the auditorium of the Omaha Police Headquarters fell silent when Chief Todd Smotter entered the room. The chief announced he was forming a multi-agency task force that would probe the recent killings of Roger and Mary Brumback and possibly links to the 2008 Dundee case. Indeed, after the murders of the Brumbacks, Omaha police now knew they were likely on the trail of a serial killer, one who was stalking doctors from Creighton University's pathology department. Derek Moyes and other detectives quickly noted the similarities in the stabbing deaths of Dr. Brumback and his wife, and the deaths 5 years ago of Tommy Hunter and Shirley Sherman in the home of Dr. Bill Hunter. The detectives also learned that the deaths of the Brumbacks had come an hour after someone had tried to break into the home of Dr. Sean DeBitra. Had Bitra been home when the mysterious killer came calling, maybe she would be dead as well. The news of the Bitra break-in was suppressed by Omaha police. No report going public. But as it was, Omaha and its news media were already buzzing about the Creighton link between Roger Brumback and Bill Hunter. This was the most sensational crime story in the city in years. In announcing the task force, Schmatterer wanted to assure the city's uneasy public. "I wouldn't want this task force coming after me," he said, speaking of his confidence that the killer or killers would be caught. But he also recognized someone else was probably listening to his words. The killer himself. If there was a serial killer at large in the city, Schmatterer believed there was a very real possibility he could strike again. In fact, the chief believed that the next killing could come at any time. Schmatterer wanted to make him think twice about that. But at the same time, the chief chose his words carefully at the podium that day, because while he wanted to instill a sense of fear in that killer, he also didn't want to provoke him. At the start, the task force had 21 members, including most of the city's best detectives, with an assist from the FBI. The detectives and their leaders set up a former conference room on the sixth floor of the Omaha Police Headquarters. Windows in the conference room were covered in white paper, Smotter making it clear he didn't want any internal leaks or rumors to jeopardize this investigation. Computers were brought in. A smart board against the wall listed the latest assignments and to-dos. Over time, the room's walls would become filled with colorful pictures, maps, flowcharts, and other work products. From the start, it was clear Creighton and its pathology department needed to be a primary focus of this task force, including any obvious connections between Brumback and Bill Hunter. Bill Hunter had been floored to learn of Brumback's death, hearing it after his colleague failed to show up to deliver a scheduled parting lecture to his Creighton colleagues the same day the bodies were discovered. Hunter, in his gut, now knew there almost had to be a Creighton tie to the killing of his son, something he'd always found impossible to grasp or believe, but still, he couldn't think of what or who it was. The investigators talk with Hunter for hours the day the Brumbacks' bodies were found, learning about his now-deceased boss and anyone in his orbit. Were there any students or staff members with a possible grudge against both Hunter and Brumback? They went to the Russian again, the man who had been the prime suspect in the killings of Tommy and Shirley. The Russian's major beef had actually been with Brumback, so in the minds of the Omaha detectives, he was definitely back on the radar. But he had an apparent alibi at the time of the Hunter house killings. Did he have an alibi for this one? Hunter also mentioned a couple of pathology residents, essentially doctors in training, who had been fired more than a decade earlier after a prank against a fellow resident. It had been so long he couldn't recall the name of one of those students, only that he was Hispanic. Given the obvious potential tie to the pathology department, the detectives also did something they did not do after the Dundee slayings 5 years earlier. They pulled the personnel records from the entire Creighton pathology department. This time, no one who had been associated with the department under Brumback and Hunter's watch would be beyond their scrutiny. As in the Dundee murders, detectives would once again find the Brumback's killer had gotten in and out of the house without leaving any physical evidence. Even again, no fingerprints on the knives used in the killings. It betrusted for Moyes what he had suspected 5 years earlier in Dundee, that the killer wore gloves as he worked. Perhaps they were medical gloves. Indeed, now that there seemed a heightened possibility the killings were related to Creighton's medical school, that also offered an obvious possible explanation as to why the victims were all cut the same way. Certainly, a medical professional could know how lethal such a cut would be. Despite such speculation, the potential Creighton pathology connection did not completely steer the investigation. Detectives still had to be open to all possibilities. As his initial assignment in the investigation, Moyes, the crime scene investigator for both the Dundee and Brumback murders, was tasked with talking to friends and acquaintances of Mary Brumback. Was there anything in her background that could make her a target? Was it possible she and Roger had marital problems? It might not have seemed the most promising of avenues for finding a serial killer, but Moyes also knew it was nitty-gritty detective work time and it needed to be done. During his casing of the crime scene, Moyes had seen papers on Mary's desk showing she was involved with Creighton's chapter of the PEO Sisterhood, a charity seeking to advance women in education. Moyes tracked down a number of Mary's PEO sisters and arranged to sit down for interviews with them. Collectively, these women were some of the kindest, most considerate do-gooders Moyes had ever met. All of the PEO sisters described themselves as extremely close to Mary, almost like real sisters. If there was anything unusual going on in her life, each of them said they would have known about it. In the end, Moyes did hear one familiar refrain from the PEO sisters, speculation that the killer had to be that crazy Russian doctor. But they also had nothing to back that belief. When it came to evidence that would actually help Moyes solve the murder, these interviews were getting him nowhere fast. On May 27th, after going through his 8th PEO interview, Moyes had heard enough. He sought out the homicide sergeant who was his boss on the task force. "The interviews I've done have been mere images of each other," he told him. "There's nothing new here." They agreed it was time to move on. A number of task force investigators were currently going through the reams of pathology department personnel files that had been culled from Creighton. The records had been sorted into binders, each bearing the name of a current or former employee. "I'll see where we stand and get you one of those binders," Sergeant Mike Ratliff told Moyes. A half hour later, Ratliff walked up to Moyes' desk and handed him a black binder containing the records of a former Creighton medical trainee, a book that over the next 48 hours would dramatically alter the course of this investigation. For the first time, Moyes read the name on the spine. Dr. Anthony J. Garcia. Means, motive, and opportunity. It's homicide 101, Moyes would later say, a mantra drilled into every detective's head. Means, motive, and opportunity together make up the three elements of a crime and the three pillars of guilt that often must be proven to make a successful criminal prosecution. Find someone that had the tools to commit the crime. Means. A reason to commit it, motive, and who was there at the right time and place, opportunity, and you might just have your man. With that in mind, Moyes sat down with a mug of coffee and a pad of post-it notes, the afternoon of May 27, 2013, and started sifting page by page to the Creighton University personnel files of Dr. Anthony J. Garcia. He was looking for anything out of the ordinary. The first pages of the Anthony Garcia file were medical licensing documents detailing his history. Garcia was a native of California who had received his medical degree in May 1999 from the University of Utah. Moyes could see from his birth date that Garcia was now just a week shy of his 40th birthday. Garcia had come to Creighton a medical resident, a freshly minted medical school grad who was seeking on-the-job training in his chosen medical specialty of pathology. Moyes saw that Garcia had started his pathology residency at Creighton in July of 2000, some 13 years earlier. That was an awfully long time ago. But Moyes quickly saw something else noteworthy about Garcia's time at Creighton. He had been fired. The records showed he'd been booted out of the school just 11 months into what should have been a 4-year residency stay. In the documents related to that firing, Moyes also saw a name that kept coming up, Dr. Chandra Bitra, the doctor whose home someone had tried to break into just before Roger and Mary Brumback were killed. As Moyes read on, it soon became clear that Garcia and Bitra were having a pretty serious conflict in the weeks leading up to the firing, the dispute spelled out in department memos and copies of emails. Given the Bitra break-in, Moyes' interest in this Dr. Garcia was rising. Moyes was suddenly placing sticky notes with his observations all over the file. Every time he turned a page, he was learning something new he thought was potentially relevant. Then Moyes flipped to a page and saw something that really shook him. Garcia's actual termination letter. It was dated May 22, 2001. And what was most striking were the signatures at the bottom. William J. Hunter, M.D. and Roger A. Brumback, M.D. Moyes thought to himself, this guy had motive to kill everybody. Hunter, Brumback, and Bitra. Moyes became so struck by the possibilities Garcia presented by mid-afternoon, he decided to have a department technician run the doctor's name through the Triple I, essentially a nationwide criminal rap sheet maintained by the FBI. The search didn't show much of a criminal record for Garcia, other than a very recent DUI arrest in suburban Chicago. That arrest listed Garcia at a Terre Haute, Indiana address, and also gave a physical description of the man. Height, 5'8", weight, 250 pounds, skin, olive. Olive skin, Moyes thought. Some of the witnesses in the Dundee case had used that exact word to describe the complexion of a mysterious man who had come and gone from the Hunter home in March 2008. He put a sticky note on that, too. Moyes downed several cups of coffee that afternoon as he went through the file. In fact, Moyes was so engrossed with his reading, he ended up staying late into the evening. By the time the detective headed for home, the doctor who had been completely unknown to him hours earlier still had not risen to the level of suspect in his eyes. But if anyone had asked Moyes that night as he went home, he certainly would have described Garcia as a person of interest. On May 28th, Derek Moyes' second day with his nose in the Dr. Anthony Garcia Creighton file, the detective put in a call to the police department in Terre Haute, Indiana, Garcia's current hometown. He asked the detective there for any records they had for Garcia. Contacts with police, auto registrations, firearm licenses. Terre Haute Detective Darren Long was very open to helping him out, the next day emailing Moyes a report of what he had found. Included in that document was an image of Garcia's Indiana driver's license. For the first time, Moyes got a look at Garcia, a meaty-faced man who indeed had olive skin. Moyes saw in the records previous addresses for Garcia, including Omaha, Chicago, Walnut, California, and Shreveport, Louisiana. This doctor had been around. Looking at Garcia's vehicle records, Moyes saw the doctor currently had both a black Mercedes SUV and a Ferrari registered to him. Then Moyes flipped to page 11 of the report, and his heart suddenly skipped a beat. From June 2007 through June 2009, the vehicle registered to Garcia at his address in Louisiana had been a Honda CRV. Oh shit, Moyes thought. Moyes wasted no time making his way over to the department's database technician, the same person who had given him the report on Garcia's criminal history 2 days earlier. This time, he asked her to run the vehicle information number for Garcia's old CRV. Moyes wanted to learn more about that vehicle. The result came back in an instant, and for Moyes, it jumped right off the screen. Color. Silver. At that moment, everything else in Moyes' world completely fell away. The car was silver. A silver Honda CRV. The exact description several witnesses had given of the car driven by the Dundee killer 5 years earlier. Moyes' mind was now in overdrive. The thoughts flashing through his head like lightning. At long last, could this really be the guy? Moyes could also see from the report that the vehicle was currently registered to a Frederick Joseph Garcia in California. It appeared a relative of Garcia still had that car. Moyes took a deep breath and pondered his next move. Then he got on his computer and found a website where he could pursue images of state license plates from past years. Looking through Louisiana plate images, he took particular interest in the one that appeared on a passenger vehicle in the state during 2008. The plate displayed a pelican silhouetted against a sunset of yellow and pink. Moyes printed off the image and took it over to the desk of Task Force Detective Doug Herote. Moyes knew Herote, a longtime Omaha detective, years earlier had extensively researched the plate on the SUV that the Dundee witnesses had observed. "Is this all consistent with what the witnesses saw?" he asked. Herote opened a drawer and pulled out his old reports. The witnesses indeed described the plate as prominently featuring pastel colors, like peach or pink. Moyes asked Herote about Garcia. Herote had been the prime interrogator of Bill Hunter the night his son was killed. "Has this guy ever come up?" Moyes asked. Herote said Hunter never mentioned Garcia. At all. Moyes started back to his desk, the significance of what he had just found sinking into his soul. In the 5 years since Dundee, he and other detectives had been absolutely bedeviled by their inability to figure out who was behind the wheel of the silver Honda CRV. Now, for the first time, there was a person of interest who drove a vehicle of the same make and color as that 2008 mystery man. Moyes knew this could be the most significant break ever in the Dundee case. Up to this point, Moyes had been keeping Sergeant Ratliff apprised of his growing interest in Garcia. Now Moyes felt Garcia had risen to another level entirely. "We need to put this guy under a microscope," Moyes told Ratliff. And to do that, Moyes would need some help. He wanted Ryan Davis and Nick Herford, two task force members who were on Moyes' regular detective team in Homicide, to work on a deep dive into Garcia. "I need Ryan and I need Nick," he told Ratliff. "And I need everyone to leave us alone." Ratliff agreed. He could see Moyes was potentially onto something big. The rest of the task force investigators would continue to follow their own paths, but from this point on, Moyes, Herford, and Davis would be laser-focused on just one man. Dr. Anthony Garcia. Coming up in Part 4, while looking into the background of Dr. Garcia, detectives find his failures at Creighton more than a decade earlier have haunted him at every turn.
Well, thank you for listening to Late Edition Crime Beat Chronicles. This series was written by Omaha World Herald staff writer Henry Cordes, based on his reporting with fellow World Herald journalist Todd Cooper, and read by the World Herald's digital director Z Long. You can get loads of other information at omaha.com, and links to relevant articles and content can be found in the show notes. Make sure you're subscribed to Late Edition Crime Beat Chronicles wherever you listen to your podcasts, so you can be the first to hear our next episode, coming out in 1 week. The show is produced and edited by me, Chris Lay, with tremendous thanks to Henry Cordes, Todd Cooper, Z Long, and the rest of the team at the Omaha World Herald for the work they put in covering, researching, and recording the story. For Lee Enterprises, I'm Chris Lay.